Frank Renner was an 18-year-old butcher. He moved to Cincinnati from St. Louis to start a new life. He didn't know anybody here. He found temporary housing, and he hit the streets with a small diary that he listed prospective employers in. On the last day of his life, he decided to take a trip to the Cincinnati Zoological Gardens. Opened in 1875, it was one of the first zoos in the U.S., and it was praised across the nation. It sat on 66 acres and combined a small collection of exotic animals and birds with cultivated gardens and world-class musical acts. The zoo was located between the hilltop suburb of Clifton and the small village of Avondale. But it was on an interurban rail line, and that made it a really easy, popular trip from downtown. Frank Renner was an average-looking man. And I don't mean that he was somewhere between ugly and handsome, although that's probably true. What I mean is that there wasn't anything about him, his appearance or his clothing, his physical features, that made him stand out. So nobody noticed him. Nobody was sure whether he'd made it to the zoo or not. Nobody could remember seeing him at all that day, and nobody knows why he wandered into Devil's Hole. But he did, and that's where he died. Until Renner, there isn't anything ominous about Devil's Hole. Not enough to merit the name. It's just physically uninviting, attractive, about 10 acres near the zoo that is densely overgrown and contains a steep ravine. To this day, no one can really know who or what led Renner into these woods, but he was swallowed up in Devil's Hole. He is so new to town that nobody notices that he's disappeared for several days, until a couple of women gathering herbs find his body. He's propped up against a tree. He has a good pair of boots, but one of them is off. His dead right hand clutches a small pair of pliers. He's been dead for 3 or 4 days, and it's summer, so the body is bloated and decomposition has begun. The women run out of the woods, terrified, and they keep running until they reach the Avondale police station, bursting in to tell Marshall Brown what they've just stumbled across. Marshall Brown and Officer Lynch then head into Devil's Hole and find the body as described, down the deep slope of the ravine. Brown leaves Lynch to police the area while he goes to Cincinnati to find the county coroner. It takes a few hours to get the coroner to the body, and darkness is falling. Nothing about the scene makes sense. He's wearing a jacket, but under it, his sleeves are rolled up, which suggests that he either put it back on in a hurry or someone put it on him post-mortem. At first, there's no sign of a wound. Then someone notices a hole in the top of his hat. Removing it, the hole in the hat aligns perfectly with a hole in the crown of his head. A .38 caliber bullet has traveled from the top of his head through his brain, fragmenting on the way, and coming to rest at the base of his skull. Someone theorizes that Renner was shot accidentally by kids who'd been target shooting earlier in the week, but it's a pretty thin theory. How does a man who is seated with his back propped up against a tree accidentally get shot on the top of his head? And again, this is crown. I don't mean forehead. The top of his head. There's no scenario that explains that trajectory. But there's no apparent motive for anyone to have murdered him, so it's officially chalked up as a freak accident. Although, there's another possible explanation, but it won't occur to Marshall Brown or anybody else until later. An Inquirer reporter arrives on the scene. He gets there shortly after the coroner. As he, his carriage driver, and a guide make their way down a steep side of the ravine by lantern light, they're stopped by a stout black man with bulging eyes. He's waving a gun around, and he tells them to turn around and leave. He says he's guarding the body and that there are already too many people around it. He's clearly drunk, and they don't believe he really has an official capacity, but they do believe that he'll use that gun. So they head back up the hill. The man then proceeds down the hill, where he begins arguing with the coroner's men, telling them that they have no right to take the body. Marshall Brown knows this man well. His name is Alan Ingalls. The marshal calls Ingalls the meanest character in the village. He arrests him for carrying a concealed weapon. Ingalls' occupation is well known to the people of Avondale. He's a resurrectionist, someone who earns a living stealing corpses and selling them to medical schools. In his highly inebriated state, it's easy to assume that he feels like he's being robbed by not letting him sell Renner's body. Being a resurrectionist is an unsavory business, but the truth about Alan Ingalls goes deeper and much darker than stealing the dead. Decades before the term will exist, Ingalls is probably a serial killer. And he probably murdered Frank Renner in Devil's Hole. But that doesn't occur to Marshall Brown or anybody else until Alan Ingalls commits a crime so heinous that it shocks the nation. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, attorney, historian, and an absolute legend in dive bars from one end of the Ohio River Valley to the other.
I'm Amy Morgan. I'm also an attorney, but I love true crime and politics. And if it's a story where history is involved, well, that's even better.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre. A true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told.
Cincinnati had 8 medical schools in the 1880s, with a total enrollment of about 1,000 students. They all had to take anatomy courses, and that required dissecting human cadavers. There were legal ways to get dissection subjects, but they were limited. For a body to go to a medical school, someone had to die in a public institution, then go unclaimed for a specified length of time. The waiting period didn't always result in the best dissection subjects, but more importantly, there just weren't enough bodies that met this criteria to fill the demand. So even the most respected medical schools worked with resurrectionists, who were the people who stole bodies and sold them to the medical schools.
Grave robbing was a crime with serious penalties for the resurrectionist, the medical schools, and their students. Both the resurrectionist and the person who bought the body at the school could be sentenced to 1 to 5 years in prison. And students who dissected an ill-gotten cadaver could theoretically get hit with a $1,000 fine and a year in prison. But most people recognized the necessity of the arrangement. If you wanted to train future doctors, you needed stolen corpses. And the risks of the job made it lucrative. Schools typically paid $15 for a body. It's roughly $500 today. And an efficient resurrectionist could steal 3 to 4 of them a night. There's no racial or gender discrimination in the business, so it attracted a disproportionate number of black practitioners. And one of the more notorious members of the local trade was a woman. Black resurrectionists also had an advantage because the key to being successful was knowing when someone died either without family or with a family that lacked the resources to guard the body or raise a fuss with the police. Regardless of race or gender, the profession was governed by unwritten codes. You typically try to take people from Potter's Field, the public burying ground for the indigent or unknown, or you took them from other cemeteries where the poor were buried. And ideally, you took people without a lot of grieving loved ones who were going to notice that the grave had been disturbed. This was mostly a practical concern. Nobody reports the theft of anything if they don't know that it's been stolen. But part of it was moral, a desire to ply the trade without hurting anyone.
But Allen Ingalls didn't live by that professional code. There were some exclusively black cemeteries, and Ingalls got into the business when he met the sexton of one of them. He'd tip Allen off about fresh burials, and he'd come in right behind the sexton, digging people up that had been buried earlier that day, and he didn't have any concern over grieving families knowing that a loved one's body had been stolen and sold. He relied on cops and courts caring even less about a rarely prosecuted crime when the victims were black. Ingalls, who had been born into slavery in Kentucky, used racial inequalities to prey on his own community. Although he was also just brazen. He'd steal the bodies of affluent people from mausoleums, and when a man was lynched by a crowd in Newport, Kentucky, Allen cut the body down before the coroner even got there and ran off with it.
Allen Ingalls lived in a house in Avondale with his wife and kids, his brother and a friend and boarder named Ben Johnson. Allen and Ben were cut from different cloths. Ben had also been born into slavery in Kentucky. He had a wife and daughter, but his wife abandoned them both years earlier. Johnson moved to Cincinnati, then moved into Allen Ingalls' house with his daughter. Allen Ingalls was a criminal, a lowlife. He was lazy, and he didn't work legal jobs. He got arrested a lot for minor crimes, and he drank. A lot. Ben Johnson didn't seem to share those basic traits. He earned an honest living sometimes, but he struggled to make ends meet. So when Ingalls told Johnson that he was a resurrectionist, told him how much money he made doing it, and said he could use a partner, Johnson became a body snatcher too. And Ingalls and Johnson had been stealing bodies together for roughly a year by early 1884. When Ingalls proposed a plan to Johnson that shocked him, Johnson told Ingalls that he wouldn't have anything to do with his plan. But Ben was a weak-willed man, and his resolve started to soften. The plan required the involuntary involvement of a man named Beverly Taylor.
Like Ingalls and Johnson, Beverly Taylor had been born into slavery. He was born in Virginia, ripped from his family as a child and sold, and then spent his formative years in Mississippi. The year after the war ended, Beverly married a woman named Elizabeth, and they moved to Cincinnati. They were hardworking, industrious people, and they did okay, but then they had some very bad luck. Beverly was a carpenter, and he kept chickens as a side job, and Elizabeth did people's laundry. They raised at least one child, a daughter, to adulthood, and they managed to save enough money to hope to retire someday, or at least work a little less. After the Civil War, it was common for banks, particularly in the South, to steal everything that black customers deposited by charging outrageous fees. This made it very common for black people to distrust banks. Beverly was no exception, so he kept the family's life savings hidden in their apartment. In 1875, someone broke in and robbed them, taking everything they'd worked for. Disillusioned with the city, Beverly and Elizabeth rented a cabin outside the village of Avondale. There was a train line that went from Cincinnati to Avondale, and their small cabin was only a mile from town, but it really felt like the middle of nowhere. They suffered another major loss when their adult daughter died. Her husband didn't think that he was equipped to raise their infant daughter on his own, so Beverly and Elizabeth adopted Emma Jane and raised her as their own. By the dawn of 1884, Elizabeth continues to be a laundress. Emma Jane goes to school and helps out around the house. And Beverly is still a carpenter, but he was getting older, having some health problems, and working irregularly. And a bad bout of rheumatism had forced him to spend most of his time off his feet since the fall of 1883. Beverly is a tall man with a gray beard. He's a nice guy with a kindly, grandfatherly-like appearance. The stage version of Uncle Tom's Cabin was popular at the time, and a lot of people compared him to the lead character. The Taylor family at this time, they don't have much in the world, but Alan Ingalls sees an opportunity to take everything they have left.
Around 10 p.m. on a Friday night, February 15th, 1884, Mr. Mills notices an odd light. Mills is the Taylor family's landlord, and he's also their nearest neighbor, living in a farmhouse about a half a mile from their cabin. Looking across the fields that separate their homes, Mills sees that the Taylor's cabin is engulfed in flames. He runs towards the fire, calling out Beverly's name as he runs, and he doesn't get a response back. By the time he reaches the cabin, it's an inferno. It's impossible to enter it or save it. If there's anybody inside, they're already dead, and there's no sign of the Taylors anywhere. Mills can't do anything except bring Avondale Marshal Brown out to the smoldering site in the morning. Brown and citizens of Avondale start a search party. It doesn't make sense that all three members of the Taylor family have disappeared without a trace. There's hope that they're alive somewhere, although maybe injured. They could have died in the fire, obviously, but there is no trace of human bodies. It was a hot fire, but pieces of the cabin and furniture remain. So it's unlikely that three bodies would have been completely incinerated. People liked the Taylor family, so there were a lot of volunteers searching the woods and also combing through the rubble of the fire looking for any traces of bodies. One of these volunteers looks out of place. Alan Ingalls seems to be trying to help with a diligence that is very unexpected for a guy who never helps anybody else. There's also a clear pattern to what Alan is doing. Anytime he runs across something hard and white in the charred remains of the cabin, any like porcelain or dishware, he holds it up and tells whoever is around him that he thinks it's bone. No one ever agrees with him, but he keeps trying.
The fire occurred on a Friday, and when there's no trace of the Taylors by Wednesday, Marshal Brown decides to check Cincinnati's medical school pickling vats. This also looks like a dead end. None of the schools have received any bodies matching the description of the Taylor family, which is pretty distinct. This includes Dr. Silly at Ohio Medical College, the largest in the city and one of the most respected in the country. Then, not long after Marshal Brown declares defeat and travels back to Avondale, something either jars Dr. Silly's memory or, it seems more likely to me, jars his conscience. He travels to Avondale to tell the marshal that somehow he'd forgotten that late on Friday night, two men using the names Jack and Harrison sold him three cadavers, an older black couple and a girl. Marshal Brown travels back to Cincinnati, and as someone who had been personally acquainted with the family, he identifies their bodies in a pickling vat. All three have obvious head wounds. Dr. Silly said he didn't think anything about this because bruising often occurred post-mortem, although there was no other obvious cause of death. It also seemed odd that Dr. Silly would have genuinely forgotten about these bodies because, in addition to buying them, he was hanging around late on a Friday night because he'd connected the bug-eyed resurrectionist with a carriage driver who could be trusted to haul them.
Yeah, I don't believe for a second that he forgot that. I assume that his first instinct when a cop showed up to ask about illegally obtained bodies was to lie. He might have been afraid of what would have happened if the bodies were eventually discovered without his help. Or, giving him the benefit of the doubt, he knew that doing the right thing in this circumstance outweighed covering his own ass. But regardless of why, he led Marshal Brown back to the bodies, and he became the key to solving the case. He didn't have all the evidence yet, But Marshall Brown knew in his gut that Allen Ingalls was one of the men going by Jack or Harrison. He staked out his house, arrested him, and charged him with triple homicide. He also arrested Ben Johnson on suspicion. Initially, Ingalls denies any knowledge of the crime, but he's held in Avondale's sole jail cell, an iron cage that sits in the middle of the basement of Town Hall. It has no privacy, and reporters are allowed to gather around it and pepper Ingalls with questions. Eventually, he can't resist any longer, and he starts responding to them.
Which isn't to say that he starts to tell the truth, but he starts to talk. He tells reporters that he was approached by a tall, thin, white man on Friday afternoon. He knows that the man is from Newport, but that's about it. He's a fellow resurrectionist, and he asks if Ingalls will help him transport some bodies. He agrees, and he helps load them at a fence row, rides into town, and helps sell them to Dr. Silly. But he doesn't know how they died, and he didn't have anything to do with burning the cabin. Unfortunately for Ingalls, Dr. Silly introduced Marshall Brown to R.B. Dixon, the man who actually transported the bodies on Friday night. Dixon runs a newspaper stand and helps transport bodies for Ohio Medical College when needed. He's an honest guy, and when he's taken to Avondale, he immediately identifies Allen Ingalls and confesses to being the hired driver. Now, at this point, Ingalls is trapped. He makes a simple admission, saying that he did it. He killed the Taylor family. Avondale police push him about an accomplice, but he says he did it all on his own. Dixon, however, identifies Ben Johnson, too, so Ingalls' half-hearted attempt to protect him is pointless. Ingalls, Johnson, and Dixon are all loaded into a wagon and driven to the Hamilton County Jail in Cincinnati. Once they're there, the full brutality of what they've done comes out.
Johnson holds his composure, and he keeps denying any involvement under questioning. But when a reporter prompts him to confess and make it right with God, it somehow causes him to blurt out, "All right, I'll tell all." And he does, starting with details of his occupation. Resurrectionists didn't dig up coffins. The more efficient method was to dig a hole at the head of the grave, knock a hole in the coffin, and pull the corpse out by the head and shoulders. He says the first time that he got a body with Ingalls, it kind of frightened him, because Ingalls behaved like a demon. But the money was good, and he felt like Dr. Silly had become a friend. The doctors and the resurrectionists referred to bodies as points, and Silly would often encourage them to get aggressive when he needed some points. On the previous Friday morning, Allen came into Ben's room and told him that he knew where they could get 3 points that night. Ben asked where, and Allen told him, quote, "There's the Taylor family. They are no good for anything else now, and we might as well have them," unquote. Johnson resisted. This wasn't the first time that Ingalls had brought this up, and Johnson wasn't willing to murder people for points. But Allen called him a coward, and eventually, Ben agreed to walk over to the Taylor cabin to scope it out. They found Beverly resting in bed. He'd been cooped up in that small cabin for months, so he's glad for the company. The three men sit around the fire, talking, joking, and laughing. Then Allen says that they have to go, but they'll come over later and they'll bring some good whiskey to share. Beverly says he'd be much obliged if they did. They did come back later, but it wasn't for a social call. In the interim, Ingalls had gone to Cincinnati to make arrangements with Dr. Silly, who hooked him up with the livery driver, Dixon. And Dixon was paid separately by the school. Ingalls established a rendezvous point near a fence row, and he returned home with 3 empty sacks.
As dusk starts to fall over the Taylor's cabin, the family's winding down. Beverly, Elizabeth, and Emma Jane are all gathered in front of the warm, glowing fireplace that flickers light and shadows across the room. A small tin lamp is the only other light. Tired from doing laundry all day, Elizabeth nestles into a chair and lights a pipe. In the village, Alan Ingalls, Ben Johnson, their families, and the rest of the household have an early dinner. Then, Alan and Ben begin the walk across frozen fields towards the unsuspecting Taylor family. When Alan and Ben reach the cabin, they spend a little time in the darkness looking in, spying on the family, knowing that this is the final moments of peace they will experience for the short rest of their lives. Beverly sits closest to the door. Elizabeth sits beside him with her pipe, and Emma Jane is the farthest into the room.
I've tried to tone this next section down and cut out some of the details, but I will warn you that what I am about to describe is heartbreaking. Outside the unlocked door, Alan pulls a 2-foot-long locust club from one of the bags. He grips it tightly, and he bursts into the cabin. Probably because he saw her as the biggest threat, Alan swings the club first into the side of Elizabeth's head. Beverly cries out and tries to stand, but Alan hits him so hard that he falls to the ground, lying motionless. Elizabeth is still alive, but she's stunned, and she's wailing in pain and terror, and she's trapped. Ingalls gives her another vicious blow or two that knocks her to the floor and renders her silent. Emma Jane has nowhere to run. She doesn't speak. She doesn't scream. She doesn't move. She's paralyzed in complete terror. All she can do is sit there, knowing that she's next. Johnson, who's still standing in the doorway, he sees that Beverly is moving a bit. So he bends down, he takes him by the throat, and he strangles him until he stops.
Then they quickly strip the bodies. Johnson doesn't say, but they probably broke their spines. A good resurrectionist can do it with one hard stomp, and it's standard procedure to fold the bodies over, making them easier to get into a sack and transport. That did make damaging and bruising the corpses common, which is why Dr. Silly said he didn't see anything suspicious in how all three people had their skulls bashed in. They were shoved into the bags and hauled across the field to the fence where Dixon met them with the wagon. As Dixon and Johnson headed slowly towards Cincinnati, Ingalls ran back to the cabin and set it on fire to hide evidence, hopefully making it look like the Taylors had simply burned to death.
Alan then ran back to the moving wagon, hopped up in the bed, and used the dead Taylor family as pillows for the 2-hour trip back to Cincinnati. At the Ohio Medical College, a lift took the bodies up to the 5th floor, where Dr. Silly was waiting. He asked Alan where he'd gotten them from, and he told him that they'd been killed in a train accident about a week earlier. This also suggests that Dr. Silly was willfully ignorant. He was the instructor of anatomy at one of the most respected medical schools in the country. He could tell the difference between bodies that were a week old and just a few hours old. Silly examined the bodies briefly and agreed to pay the standard $15 each. But he was only carrying $20 with him. And that was common. Resurrectionists usually came back on a later day for payment. But this is all that these men would be paid. On the way out, Ingalls gave Johnson $5 of the $20. And in the days ahead, Ingalls borrowed $1.50 from Johnson and never paid him back. That was something that Johnson developed a really odd fixation with. Maybe it was because, in the end, he realized that he had helped murder an entire family for $3.50.
Because the murders were committed in Avondale, they had to be returned there for arraignment and a probable cause hearing. Around 1,000 people lined the route, men and women of all ages, standing in rebuke. Because they didn't understand what had happened, they didn't grasp the horror. Children ran in and out of the crowd, playing, joking, and shouting things out to each other about the kindly old man that they all knew as Uncle Beverly. The crime shocked people of all backgrounds, and Cincinnati as a whole mourned the Taylor family and expressed their horror and contempt at Ingalls and Johnson. But Black Cincinnatians outnumbered whites in the crowd that lined the road and packed the town hall basement for the arraignment. Both Ingalls and Johnson had been freed from slavery and had been given control of their own destinies. And what they chose to do with their lives was to prey upon people who faced similar challenges, prey upon their community, and their community hated them for it.
When asked how he pled, Johnson hung his head and said, "I'm guilty," in a trembling voice. Before the question was even asked, Ingalls blurted out, "I didn't do it." He saw Johnson's contrition as a chance to shift all of the blame onto him. He'd start telling reporters and fellow inmates and anybody that would listen that Johnson was both the mastermind and the one who used the club to kill all three people. Nobody would believe him. He was clearly, by far, the more psychopathic of the two. But the crowd outside didn't see a big distinction. It had grown in both size and agitation during the hearing. Even with extra officers sent for protection, it was a harrowing experience to get the prisoners back into the wagon, crack the whip, and drive the horses tearing down the road out of Avondale as the crowd shouted, "Lynch them! Lynch them!"
The next day, a crowd started gathering around Habig's funeral home in Cincinnati, where the Taylor family was being prepared for burial. People had to be moved out of the way to load the caskets. Beverly's and Elizabeth's bodies were loaded into two black hearses. Little Emma Jane's hearse was white. A city in mourning parted as the somber procession headed north out of town. In Avondale, the family was laid in state at town hall. It took hours for roughly 1,300 members of the village to file past the open caskets and pay their respects. The town paid for the funeral, as well as guards to watch the bodies after burial, a precaution to make sure they didn't wind up in Dr. Silly's pickling vat a second time.
Like William Berner and Joe Palmer, William H. Pugh would prosecute Ingalls and Johnson. He was new to the job, having recently been sworn in as Hamilton County prosecutor. Despite being raised a Quaker, Pugh was an ardent proponent of capital punishment, and he rode to victory in the election on a wave of newspaper coverage about heinous murders and a promise to crack down on crime. Nevertheless, the shouts of "lynch them" that came from the crowd that closed in around Ingalls and Johnson on their way back to jail were ominous, because lynchings were still common in the 1880s, especially when communities grew disillusioned with their local law enforcement, a feeling that was being fed by Cincinnati newspapers.
Today, we hear the history of lynching mostly in connection with racial violence in the Deep South. But lynching was pretty common any time a community was particularly disgusted by a crime and didn't trust the justice system. In the late 1870s and early 1880s, successful and attempted lynchings happened in towns near Cincinnati on multiple occasions. Sometimes law enforcement seemed to turn a blind eye, but mobs usually overwhelmed police. In November 1881, for example, an organized group of vigilantes broke into the Athens County Jail in Athens, Ohio, overpowered the sheriff and guards, took accused rapist Christopher Davis from his cell, and hung him from the side of a bridge. The lynching was so popular that, despite a bunch of witnesses, no one was ever charged for murdering Davis.
In the Davis case, an ex-prosecutor near Athens told a reporter that the lynching was motivated by a feeling that, quote, "the administration of justice in Athens County has in the past been a failure," unquote. That was both a common motivation and response. In Ironton, Ohio, for example, about 140 miles upriver from Cincinnati, a group of masked, highly organized men overpowered the jailer and hung an accused murderer from a tree. Afterward, the local newspaper editorialized that the lynching, quote, "was right because of the way the criminal law is now being administered," unquote. The paper even suggested that judges and juries should be lynched in some cases. Here, too, the killing was so popular with the community that nobody was arrested for the lynching.
Black citizens were lynched disproportionately by population, but most people lynched in Ohio were white, and an 1882 incident in Crawford County, Ohio, that's just north of Columbus, showed that black citizens could be as apt as their white counterparts to lynch defendants when they were disillusioned with the justice system or morally outraged by a crime. When a black man named Frank Fisher was accused of raping a 13-year-old white girl, a black man emerged as the primary leader of a 2,000-member mob that rushed the jail, broke in with hammers and crowbars, pulled Fisher from his cell, and hung him from a tree. As many as 4,000 people in a community of 5,700 reportedly watched. In a final act of public sentiment, his body was left hanging for 5 days. And no one was charged with a crime.
Lynches could be highly organized. In Ashland, Kentucky, upriver from Cincinnati, your hometown, Amy, George Ellis was one of three defendants who raped two young girls before murdering them and a boy, then burning down the family home. It was an unimaginably heinous crime. But Ellis was plagued by guilt, came forward and confessed, and he testified for the prosecution against one of his accomplices without getting any special deal from the prosecution. Partly because of this, the jury took some mercy on Ellis and sentenced him to life in prison rather than hanging. The Cincinnati Inquirer, in response, threw a fit. They wrote that, quote, "Ellis deserves hanging or no punishment at all," unquote. The paper helped fuel threats of lynching, and the Kentucky National Guard had to protect the jail, which they did successfully, until the threat seemed to subside and they let their guard down. Then, roughly 60 men hijacked a train, drove it to the front of the jail, got keys by force, and used the train to take Ellis to the scene of the crime and hang him from a sycamore tree. An estimated 1,000 people were there when the coroner arrived, but not a single witness could be found in that crowd somehow. And the Cincinnati Inquirer wrote that the court was the only responsible party for the lynching because it had forced the community to rely on Judge Lynch.
The town of Newport, Kentucky is immediately across the river from Cincinnati, and a very brazen lynching happened there, just a short walk from downtown Cincinnati, back in March of 1879. Peter Klein was released from the Ohio Penitentiary early on a 3-year sentence for assault and attempted rape, because apparently 3 years was too long for assault and attempted rape. A free man with nothing to do, he traveled over to northern Kentucky just because he was drunk and bored. Passing a farmer on the man's way into town, Klein knew that the farmer's wife would be home for a while. He went to the house, forced his way in, beat her, savagely assaulted her, tied her up with bedsheets, stole a few things from the house, and on his way out, mockingly told her to get loose from the bindings if she could. Klein was arrested a few days later and locked up in Newport. Given free access to the prisoner, a reporter from the Cincinnati Inquirer got a full confession from Klein and printed all of the horrific details. Enraged citizens started flocking to Newport and surrounding the courthouse. Several days later, an organized posse stormed the building. They beat and overwhelmed both the mayor of Newport and the jailer and took the keys. A small, orderly group of men walked to Klein's cell and pulled him out. He didn't bother to fight, leaving with them silently, with his head down. A crowd rode Klein to the farmhouse of his victim, then led him into the house for a positive identification. That now consisted of around 700 of what the Cincinnati Inquirer referred to as, quote, Campbell County's best and most respected people, unquote. The lynch mob identified a good tree, bound Klein's hands, and stood him up in the back of a wagon with a noose around his neck. The buggy driver slapped the horse, but Klein was pulled rather than jerked from the seat by the noose. As he slowly strangled to death, the crowd started shouting his last words to his bound victim. Get loose, if you can.
The Cincinnati Inquirer summarized public opinion of this by writing, quote, Very few will admit squarely that they approve of any lynching, but none were found to condemn anybody for assisting at the work. If there was any disposition to say nay, it was a very mild disposition, only half-hearted. And even the officers were lukewarm, from the patrolman up to the governor of the state, unquote. America's system of due process and a defendant's right to a vigorous, adversarial defense are some of our most important constitutional rights. The case of Christopher Davis in Athens, Ohio, that we mentioned a few minutes ago, is the worst-case scenario of lynchings. We'll never know for sure because there wasn't a trial to vet the evidence, but the modern consensus is that Davis was innocent. In fact, if Davis, who was a married father of two and a well-liked, hard-working farm laborer, was having a consensual affair with a white farmer's wife, as many speculate, he might have been lynched a day before his trial because he was innocent. But conversely, Peter Klein's lynching in Newport, it's the other side of the coin. Klein was 100% guilty. He had to be driven to the scene of his crime to be positively identified because he had beaten his victim so badly during a savage sexual assault that her broken ribs prevented her from getting out of bed. And the crime was only possible because Klein, who would have clearly been classified as a sexual predator today, was let out early on a paltry 3-year sentence for assault and attempted rape. Lynching wasn't the right answer, but it's sure as hell easy to see how it felt like it.
In the second episode, in T.C. Campbell's defense of Crazy Joe Payton, we talked about the state of psychiatry. That this was a period when we were starting to understand mental illness, but in very crude and flawed ways. The same thing applied to how the prison system should operate. It needed to punish people, but there was a growing hope that a well-run prison could also reform people and fix whatever flaw made them criminals. The trial process was also maturing. Courts were evolving on what due process really meant, taking the role of ensuring fair trial seriously, and trying to sentence people fairly. But sometimes, especially when the media got involved. The results seemed to defy common sense and go soft on hard crime.
We're still struggling with these same issues today. There's this ideal in the legal system that it's better to let 10 guilty people go free than convict one innocent one. But media coverage feeds an opposite narrative and an opposite value system. If you overconvict and oversentence 10,000 people and wreak long-term havoc on 10,000 families as a result, it is not a headline. But if you sentence one person to less than the maximum, or let that person out of prison on probation, and he or she, usually he, murders somebody, that's a major headline. It's probably even national news. That's how the media works today, and it's how it worked in the 1880s. Anytime that newspaper reporters thought that a sentence was too light, it was treated as further proof that the justice system could not be trusted to handle terrible crimes.
And Alan Ingalls and Ben Johnson's murder of the Taylor family was definitely a terrible crime. This wasn't the first time in world history that people had been murdered with the motive of selling their bodies to medical schools. Scottish serial killers William Burke and William Hare are credited with being the first to do it in Edinburgh in 1828. They murdered 16 people, and their crimes were so famous that burking became an established verb. The definition of burking actually involves suffocating people, because that made the bodies more valuable as dissection subjects. But it was still applied to Ingalls and Johnson, who were called the first burking murders in the United States. That, and the sheer brutality of the crime, made Ingalls and Johnson national news, and they helped feed the narrative that Cincinnati was engulfed in a terrifying crime wave.
In episode 2, we introduced you to T.C. Campbell, a brilliant, famous, and morally pliable defense attorney. In episode 3, we told you about the murder of William Kirk and the boy murderers, William Berner and Joe Palmer, who committed the crime. In the next episode, we're going to tell you about William Berner's trial, dazzle you with more of T.C. Campbell's courtroom brilliance. Then we're going to circle back to why we just told you all that stuff about lynch mobs. In the meantime, if you'd like to learn more about the world's first case of burking, check out the Crimes of the Centuries episode, Resurrectionist Murder for Profit, in Season 3, Episode 19. On a personal note, you know, Amy, I've known you since 1996.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I've never known about you until tonight?
What?
I say vigilante, you say vigilante. And I think we might have to call the whole thing off.
Maybe so.
That's it for now. Special thanks to Grab Bag Collab Network for their help on this podcast. And please check out grabbagcollab.com for more podcasts that we think you're really going to love. And additional thanks to our producer and director, Dan Fennessy. We will see you guys next episode.
See you next week.